ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is John Gallagher, an influential and award-winning filmmaker, director, writer, producer, author, historian, and educator with a vast knowledge of films and filmmaking. He wrote and directed the critically acclaimed feature Blue Moon, starring screen legends Ben Gazzara and Rita Moreno, and also directed and co-wrote the award-winning cult comedy The Deli, now celebrating its 20th anniversary. His newest film, The Networker, starring Sean Young and William Forsythe, was released in April. He's also the acclaimed author of Film Directors on Directing, a collection of his interviews with such filmmakers as François Truffaut and Dennis Hopper. His newest books, Nothing Sacred, The Cinema of William Wellman, and Hollywood's Forgotten Master, The Life and Times of Tay Garnett, will be published later this year. John Gallagher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Gabriella.
You're one of the most hyphenated people I've ever interviewed, a producer, teacher, writer, and director. What's your favorite thing to do?
By far, direct. Those other hyphenates actually came really from necessity. As an independent filmmaker, I have to go out and, raise the money. I've done everything in my career with private equity, with the exception of one studio-financed film. Again, the necessity of kind of being able to do things my way and to protect my work, that I became a producer. And even in one very notable case, we actually also became a distributor. We self-distributed a feature that I wrote and directed called The Deli, which has become something of a cult New York indie movie. And that was done, in fact, the Long Island Film Festival this spring is celebrating the 20th anniversary of The Deli. And this was a case that is actually still applicable today for indie filmmakers, in that the picture 20 years ago cost $750,000. We had a lot of names in the movie, and we had a lot of names in the film who weren't names at the time, who became names 2 years later with the success of The Sopranos. And we did get offers from distributors for the film, but knew that we would not receive any other revenue down the line from the distributors. Just the way the business is set up, it favors the distributors. So we decided to release the film ourselves theatrically. We also, and this was really unknown territory for us, we released the film on video, on home video, and discovered that there are a dozen companies I had certainly never heard of who control home video distribution. And we were very successful doing that, and then eventually we got tired of being distributors. It's an awful lot of work, and we laid off the rights to a company called Castle Hill, but we retained the DVD rights, which at the time, people were just starting to talk about it, and then later made a deal with Synapse and Warner's Ryko for the DVD, and they came out with a beautiful edition. And to kind of put the cap on this story, many times you make a deal with a distributor for 15 years, and at the end of the 15 years, the rights revert back to the producers. So the rights have reverted back, and they're being now resold for cable and Blu-ray and overseas. So a well-made, certainly popular picture, indie picture, can have a long life in perpetuity. I mean, the movie Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets did not start to make money until the Warner Brothers distribution deal expired and the rights returned to Marty and the producer, Jonathan Taplin. Of course, by then he was Martin Scorsese. At the time it came out, he was this promising new director.
Right. Well, it's interesting because when you say all of your work was privately financed, I think we need to brag a little bit more than that, because it was 21 features and 25 shorts or more than that, actually, which is kind of amazing that you've done that much.
A lot.
But now...
and it's funny because I tell this often because I'm also a teacher. I've taught directing at the School of Visual Arts, and I continue to teach a very popular film acting class at One-on-One in New York. And I tell my young students that, well, A, they must know our film heritage. They must know what's come before. I give them a list of 100 movies that I consider essential. And, you know, they need to know. You know, there's nothing new. The technology is new. That's it. But it's still, you know, I've just completed two long-in-the-works books on classic directors, Tay Garnett, who did the original Postman Always Rings Twice, and Wild Bill Wellman, who won the first Academy Award for Best Picture with Wings and did, you know, Public Enemy, Oxbow Incident, et cetera. And going into the archives and looking at the daily production reports on all these movies and looking at the memos that were going back and forth from the studio head, it's the same problems, the same issues. You know, this actor is unhappy, they want more lines, or, you know, nothing in terms of the filmmaking that has changed. It's just, again, the technology and the fact that, unlike, you know, William Wellman directed 30 feature films in like 3 years in the early because you'd finish a movie on Friday and on Saturday there'd be a new script on your lawn and you'd start on Monday because it was a factory. Everything was set up. Everything was ready to go. And today, you know, I have to, especially as a writer, I write most of my stuff. So I have to write the script. I do a lot of readings while I'm table reads while I'm writing. Then I've got to raise the money, and that means putting together a cast that will, at least a couple of names, that will mean something.
One of the things I'm curious about is how the digital revolution has or hasn't changed how you go about obtaining funding, and also how globalization and the way rights are now, like with Netflix and Amazon and the way they're going global, how that's impacted how you raise money and where your money comes from.
Absolutely. In fact, in both those cases, very much so on a positive side. Now, the digital revolution is one reason why I've been able to be so prolific, you know, over the last 10 years, say, as opposed to, you know, 20 years ago when, you know, we were shooting on 35 millimeter and the distribution was basically, you know, you would have a screening and invite distributors and hope for some bids to happen. Today, one can self-distribute much easier. While there are less theatrical opportunities, there are many more platforms to show your work. And I also would say that what's happened is that because there are so many film festivals, that becomes, I'm talking for an indie now, that becomes your theatrical red carpet party, you know, big screen experience. If you want your movie to open in some kind of limited format theatrically, you have to raise some extra money for distribution, say $50,000 to $100,000, and give that money to a distributor who, in what is called a service deal, and they take their 10 or 15%, and everything else goes to you, and you've got a theatrical release, say, you know, at one screen in New York, at one screen in L.A., and that certainly helped with your ancillary, you know, rights. And the other thing globally is that, you know, as has it has always been, American movies are still very much in demand around the world. I go almost every year now to a film festival in Germany, the Oldenburg Film Festival. I've been going since the first year, 1994. I've had 16, 17 films play there. And you know, I've actually made sales to German TV in one instance on a movie called Men Lie that cost $120,000. We sold to German TV for $100,000. So that almost, you know, basically almost recouped the whole film.
And one of the things I'm curious about, I know when films have box office, that's a way to sort of help you get funding for your next film. But if you're streaming and you're, you know, how important are rankings like the Apple ranking? How useful, how transparent are these numbers? Can you use them? Or is it just purely you get the money today and you've got to still deal totally separately tomorrow? Like how do these new streaming platforms help you build reputation?
It's still, you know, very much developing. There is no, you know, chart that I'm aware of that tells you how much a particular film made, you know, on Netflix or on Amazon, et cetera. I mean, the bottom line to get the next movie is to recoup for your investor and, you know, and a couple of bucks more than that.
Right.
You know, and now the movie that I wrote and produced, Mel Brooks' son Nick directed it. He and I wrote it. Mel exec produced it. And that film is called Spam. This past October, it was acquired by Sony Pictures Home Entertainment, and it is now available on Amazon, iTunes, DVD, etc. The results are not in yet, at least that I'm privy to, as to, you know, how much that brought in. My most recent feature that I directed, a movie called The Networker, was just acquired by The Orchard, which is another Sony-owned company, and they're going to launch that in April. I'm a little more involved with that, so I'll have a better idea of, you know.
When you say launch that, where will they launch it?
They'll launch on every platform, plus DVD and Blu-ray, and the jury is still out about giving it a small theatrical.
Oh, okay.
So, but that's a very... tell you that movie cost almost like it may be the lowest budgeted film I've ever directed. We shot it in 15 days. We had no dollars at all for overtime. We had a different location every single day. We had a rather large cast. We had William Forsythe, Sean Young, and Stephen Baldwin as our names, all wonderful actors, but as our, you know, quote, name actors, you know, to help sales. There's certainly exceptions, you know, to everything in this business, but it really is important for a low-budget indie to have one or two names. And, you know, I know a lot of new filmmakers get a little intimidated by that, but with a good, you know, connected casting director, like a Judy Henderson or a Steven Vincent or Caroline Sinclair or all people I've worked with, it's quite remarkable who will get submitted, you know, for your film. So that's really important. I mean, I can give you a brief case history of the film that I am working on diligently right now. It's a kind of a gritty serial comic tale about a young actress who moves to New York to go to acting conservatory. I taught for 6 years at the Neighborhood Playhouse, so I'm very familiar with that world, and she gets into every kind of trouble imaginable. I've done this before. The leads are all young actors who trained with me at one-on-one. Rather than auditioning them, I had them in class for 6 hours, and I really got to see and know what they can do. So I wrote those leads specifically for them. Since then, one of them, Emmy Tanzi, that is co-starred in a big picture that's coming out most likely next Halloween. And I have my little claim to fame as well, the many actors that I've either discovered or cast very early on, like Amanda Peet and Gretchen Mol and John Leguizamo, Dennis Leary, Matt Lillard, Vinnie Pastore, etc. So these are all terrific young actors, and they work through most of the film. But then I need names to sell the film, and that has to fit in with the characters as written. So,
right. You
know, I'm very close. So I've done a lot of work with, played Paulie Walnuts on The Sopranos. Vinnie Pastore played Big Pussy on The Sopranos. Federico Castelluccio played Furio on The Sopranos. So we've got three Sopranos stars. And, of course, recently the show was named by Rolling Stone as the best show, number one show ever. Then I've got Burt Young, Academy Award nominee for Rocky, who I directed in The Deli Blue Moon. And I've got Sally Kirkland, another Academy Award nominee. I've got Lucy Pohl, who is in Fantastic Beasts, number one global box office film of the year. And they only work a few days, but they kind of support the new actors. So that's a pretty darn good.
So simply having a name, even if they're only there for a day or two, they don't have a large role, that's enough to secure the financing and to get you carriage.
Yeah, for example, on The Deli, it was the same premise. And we had, you know, Ice-T for 2 days and Chris Noth for 1 day, Jerry Stiller for a day, Debbie Mazar for 2 days, you know, but it's sprinkled throughout the film in many cases. You know, so it doesn't look like, we see what they did there. And it's the same thing on the movie is called Sarah Q, which we hopefully start shooting in mid-March. And then what happens, and it's a $250,000 film. I mean, that's nothing. It's an 18-day shoot. But I have an exceptional sales rep. He will take a product reel, a teaser, if you will, to the marketplace in Cannes in May. And he has already introduced the film at some of the more recent markets. So you kind of have, you know, we always try to have our end game in place, like really, you know what's going to happen with the film. I told them specifically, don't try to get any pre-sales because, for example, let's say Germany offers us $50,000 as a pre-sale. Pre-sale, you know, before the film is done. Well, if we wait till the film is completed, that number could be $150,000, you know?
Right.
And we are always responsible to the investors. We want to make them happy. We want them to come back.
Do you have the same investors time and time again? Is that sort of how it goes?
Sometimes. It depends, you know, on the kind of movie. The films that I do tend to be, I mean, I always, you know, make sure that there's a market for them. That's really important. Mm-hmm. But they're not, you know, I'm not making like, you know, horror movies. I'm not making like the typical, you know, I'm making, for lack of a better, I mean, these are director-driven films. I like to think that, you know, these are films that only I could make, that it could only come out of my warped imagination. and so that can be, you know, you still have to make sure that there's a commercial element to these films.
For these young actors who you've given the start to, have you ever had them come back and appear in subsequent films as your name to get you revenue?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been, you know, Vinnie Pastore, I've been working with since 1990. I put him in his second movie. He had a very small part. He was a mafia bodyguard who gets whacked. I've done, I don't know, 4 or 5 or 6 films with him. Many, many actors. I mean, if you look at the cast of my films, there's a lot of repeat actors. Because I'm very blessed that they're very devoted to me. Like if I ask somebody to jump off the Empire State Building, the last week, she said, I land on my back or my stomach. And that's an exaggeration, of course, but it's not that far from the truth. I also know that, you know, I know them so well. We've become family, personal friends. So I know, you know, what they're capable of. I know how to push them. Mm-hmm. And there are many, again, I have many, many film actors that I've worked with, you know, repeatedly. And every film has a new batch. And they, you know, they kind of come in and get welcomed to the family. And, you know, when you have that kind of atmosphere, on the last day of the shoot, Gabrielle, they're crying that it's over. I mean, it's also, and I've also had, I've had three marriages on my films, three broken engagements, a lost virginity. I mean, you know, I'm three quarters Italian. We play music, we dance, we laugh. The work gets done, but it's a very loving. I rule with love, not fear. I will kick off after a take. I'll kick off applause, and the crew joins in. And then I said, that was great. Whatever, let's do it again. You know, I mean, all those directorial tricks I've learned, not only from experience, but also from studying, you know, John Ford and Wellman and Walsh and, you know, Fellini. And, you know, I used to write to all, I wrote a letter to Fellini. He wrote me back. I wrote a letter to Francois Truffaut when I was in college asking if I could interview him and send a cassette tape, and he wrote me back saying in French, I'm running up and down Beacon Street in Boston, saying, can anybody speak French? And he said, no, I refused the cassette tape. And then I was like, oh, basket. Then it said, but I will be in New York for the New York Film Festival if you will call this number and you can come interview me. So I wrote to everybody. I wrote to Spielberg, he wrote me back. And I learned so much from interview. I mean, I interviewed silent movie stars. I interviewed so many directors. My first book, Film Directors on Directing, had 21 of my interviews, including the Truffaut interview. And that was a standard text in many film schools in the 90s. And you know, I've always found, you know, the directors, the DPs, everyone to be very giving and forthcoming. Because I'm not asking them, like, I interviewed Lee Marvin, a career interview with Lee Marvin a year before he died. He loved it. He was so candid because I wasn't asking him about, you know, so there's a tree you had an affair with Donna Reed when you were shooting Gun Fear. Yeah, I was asking about the craft. And, right. You know, and certainly Lee Marvin, you know, was always getting asked about, you know, he invented the term palimony, well, you know, it came from because of his situation. So, you know, I've found that, again, talking to some of these greats, I mean, they're so, just so giving, and they want you to learn, you know. So that's been, you know, for me, you know, a very important part of the whole process. You know, when I started, I was a kid. I used to tape record credits off of old movies and put them on index cards and write down notes. And I got straight A's, so my parents would let me, in pre-VCR years, you know, set the alarm for 3 a.m. to watch Citizen Kane or the Marx Brothers. You know, and I gave myself this education without realizing it. Yeah, I went to film school. I went to Emerson College, and that was fun because you could get your hands on the equipment like day one. And I published a film journal that got me into interviewing any of these people. But I was, you know, 22 years old, knew no one in the business, and a buddy and me, we raised money to make a feature film, and it was East Coast beach movie about Italian kids from Brooklyn and preppy kids from mainline Philadelphia, representing both of my, you know, my adolescence, and we made it and we sold it to New Line, and
wow.
So, but I had no one to give me advice, and I've really taken on the role of mentor many times, and I want every independent filmmaker to do well and make money for their investors. I've had investors ready to go on the film. Then they checked with their account, and then they said, don't do it. I had a client. He put up money. The movie is sitting on the director's mother's shelf, you know? So I want everyone to do well. But there are things you can do to make sure you do well, such as speak to a sales agent and say, you know, okay, here's three actors. Which one means the most? Talk to casting directors. I mean, they're vital to the process. Work with people that are more experienced than you. You know, I was smart enough to do that on my first film, and that's the main reason that I had a second. That I got a second film.
Would you ever, you've done a lot of independent features. Right now, there is a trend for a lot of it's in television. Certainly, it's the golden age of content. A lot of scripted series, the most expensive scripted series was, I think, produced last year. Would you ever consider, you know, signing on to do original scripted materials at one of these over-the-top places or for a network? Is that something?
Absolutely. In fact, I signed with a new agent just a couple of weeks ago, and that's one of the goals. I mean, I've written for TV. I directed a TV pilot for National Lampoon. Saying that I'll do it as long as I can also turn it into a short in the likely probability that it does not get picked up, that just like most pilots don't get picked up. So it did get picked up, and it had a nice life on the festival circuit, but absolutely. You know, they're, again, with all these platforms, and I know people that have said some very successful web series, you know, that got picked up, and you know, a close associate of mine, it just, you know, did a brief kind of TV pilot teaser in hopes of getting a pilot out of it. But, traditionally, that's kind of been the hardest thing of all, certainly for an independent to do. I mean, you know, pilots traditionally are, you know, commissioned by networks, you know, to production companies with TV track records, you know. But maybe that's changing. Hopefully it is with some of these new new outlets.
Well, I think what we're seeing is new voices, new stories. And so as they're trying to build sort of longer tail or niche audiences within their larger offering, I mean, if you look at what Amazon has and Transparent, for instance, you know, it's something a little different than the traditional fare. And so I was curious about that. And in terms of distribution and discovery, once you are, you know, in terms of viewers discovering the content, once you have gotten your piece through your sales agent, blown out to all these outlets, how involved are you in helping to market it? Or is that really taken on by those other people?
Well, you know, we use other people, but certainly we're very involved in that through social media. You know, for example, on the networkers, since that's coming in April, every day on our Facebook page, there is something about the movie. You know,
do you also use Instagram and Snapchat or?
Yeah, we haven't been to Snapchat yet, but certainly Instagram, Twitter. We're going to, on Sarah Q, we're going to do a video blog every day. And part of the fun of that is, particularly with some of the guys from The Sopranos, who, again, I've just known for so long, and they're so funny in real life. I'm coming up with bits that we can kind of do between, while this has being set up. They're just hysterical. They have no filter, and they're just, you know, I mean, super, super funny. We'll have to get some mileage out of that.
Right.
You know, and again, we'll play some festivals, because for an indie, the best way to build a reputation for your film is on the festival circuit. I mean, I don't want to spend a year on it, but some selective festivals and, one good thing when you have a real veteran actor in your cast, many times the festival will say, hey, we'll take your movie, we'll give Burt Young a Career Achievement Award. That happened quite a bit on Blue Moon, because we had Ben Gazzara and Rita Moreno. So, right. You know, there were a number of festivals we played where they got honored.
Right. So it's a way to give both. How, of the festivals, are there certain ones that you target because they help you to secure deals more readily than others? As you say, you don't want to be out there all year long. What would you say for the independent who's out there, what are the ones that you target? What are the long shots? What are the don't bothers?
Well, you know, you do have to target first the A-list festivals.
Mm-hmm.
The Sundance, Slam Dance, Tribeca, South by Southwest, because there are distributors there looking to buy. There, of course, also they are the long shot festivals. The Delhi world premiered at South by Southwest,
mm-hmm.
And we did get offers out of that festival. Then there's kind of the next tier, you know, the Florida Film Festival. You know, Orlando is very good, Seattle, Denver, Mill Valley, Los Angeles. But you have to be very careful because you want to make sure, particularly with a feature as opposed to a short, that your first festival, your world premiere, is at the best festival you can possibly get into.
I see.
To the point where if you are, you know, waiting to hear from Tribeca, but you have been invited to the Bronx Film Festival, you can then call Tribeca and say, because Tribeca, for example, they insist on a New York regional premiere.
Mm-hmm.
So even for shorts. So you call Tribeca and say, you know, we just got invited to the Bronx Film Festival and, you know, do you have any results for us? And they'll let you know within a couple of days. If you're in contention or not. I mean, they don't want to see you miss an opportunity, you know? But again, you know, at these festivals, you know, you want to build up, hopefully get some good reviews, but maybe you get an award. As I said, in Germany, in Oldenburg, we made TV deals. In Brazil, the Sao Paulo Film Festival, we made a Brazilian TV deal, you know. It's just because it's a really great. And then in some cases, you do a festival because the following week it's going to open in that particular market theatrically.
Right.
So it's just all, you know, all that cross promotion is, you know, is just so, it's so true. And it's pretty much anything, you know, you can do to get the word out. And, social media is just like, you know, it's crazy. I mean, we, for example, on the networker, the producer has 5,000 Facebook friends and I'm almost there. And when we get close, you know, we're really going to, you know, be plugging that. So that's almost 10,000, you know, access to 10,000 potential, you know, viewers, whether they're, you know, looking at it on Amazon or they're going to a theater or, you know, what have you. But so that's a crucial thing. And just getting back to something that you asked about earlier, there's never been a better time for someone to actually make a movie. My friend Sean Baker directed his film Tangerine on his iPhone, got mm-hmm. it to Sundance, got theatrical, and you know, it was a hit.
Oh my gosh!
You know, so that's insane. I mean,
that is insane.
And you know, he did. Apparently, there were certain lenses he could put on it, but even so, and that's just wonderful. I mean, there's no excuse for anyone who wants to make a movie not to make a movie. I mean, the cameras are so inexpensive. You can edit on a laptop. You know, we used to go up to Sound One and expensive post-production facilities and do all the editing on a flatbed at 35 mil. Now we edit in my editor's apartment. And he'll do a cut and email it to me. And I'll say, change this. So it's never, but that also means that there's a ton more product out there. So
right. The
bottom line there is still, what is the most important aspects of filmmaking despite the ease of the technology, it's still writing, directing, acting.
Right. It's still the story and communicating the story, right?
Plays the thing. It was true in Shakespeare's day, and it's really, you know, really still true. And if you're doing, you know, a genre film, and a horror film is, that is a reason why many filmmakers choose that genre as their first film. It's not cast contingent. You can cast all unknown, wonderful actors. Look at all the great actors that their first movie was a horror film. Johnny Depp, Tom Hanks, George Clooney, Zellweger, Rooney Mara. I mean, the list is endless. So I tell the young actors, I mean, make keep an extra lookout for auditions for horror movies, because you can have a starring role without being a name, and you get to emote, you know? Scream, run, kick the monster's butt, you know? All of that, you know, is really true. And, you know, but you, those still, the genre, what becomes more important, unless you've got some incredibly unique new story angle, is the direction, is the execution of how you're telling your story, you know? And, I mean, again, that's why I said earlier about your film legacy. You're making a horror movie? Watch the 1942 Jacques Tourneur film, Cat People, which was basically shot. A lot of it is in shadows because they didn't have any set. You know, 6 feet across a set, and that's all you saw, and the rest was shadows. It's a brilliant film, really scary. Scorsese talks about it all the time. And, you know, again, to see, it always used to dishearten me, and I would launch it into a tirade in class, like actors were worse, budding directors, if it wasn't like post-1980, they'd never seen it, they had no interest in seeing it. I changed that very quickly.
Well, I want that list of 100 movies. I think that's a necessary thing.
Awesome.
That send me the list. And actually, we have run through our time. I want to thank you so much for speaking with me and talking to me about how digital world has adjusted how you go about doing the filmmaking, how it hasn't changed how you go about filmmaking as well. I think both those points are interesting. May change the technology, may change the way you raise the money. But ultimately, the storytelling and the craft of filmmaking is still what it's always been in those 100 films that everybody should see. I would love to get that list. So please send it my way.
I will.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, John Gallagher. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.